life's been going on. Besides, I fell off my bicycle, but you know, you can't help those things in these bad weather conditions.
Yes, it's true. And you know why you fell off your bicycle?
Yes. I braked on a greasy corner. Amateur mistake.
Gravity's the answer. Gravity's why people fall off their bicycles. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I am your loving host. My name's Todd Conklin, and I'm really glad you're here. Hey, today's going to be a kind of an interesting podcast. I think you're going to like it a lot. We're going to do quite a bit of discussion around the notion of understanding the disaster incubation theory, but we're going to kind of reimagine it. And I'll give you some background on that. Other than that, the podcast is going to be great today. I'm looking forward to spending time with you. I hope you're doing good. How are things going in the midst of this winter if you're in North America or Europe? Okay? You having a good time? Things for me are great. This year's theme is going to be slow. I'm slowing down. I'm going to try to take things a little slower. I'm never terribly good at that, but it seems like something I'd be good at. And, you know, I'm desperately trying to jump into self-improvement, but I'm always kind of desperately jumping into self-improvement. Lots of good feedback on what's been going on so far. Tell your friends about the podcast. More is better, they tell me, and that seems to be a big deal. And so that's always worth our time. But for those of you that listen with great regularity, I'm so glad you do. And that number seems to keep growing and growing and growing, and that's great. I mean, that's a big part of what we want to do. Today's podcast features Mike Lauder. And Mike worked for a long time in really the UK and has spent a tremendous amount of time, 30 plus years or so, understanding risk management. And risk is such a complex topic that covers so many areas of interest that it never ceases to stun me what I learn when I think about risk. Mike just wrote a book, and the book is called In Pursuit of Foresight. It's Ashgate. You can pick it up through Ashgate or whatever the new version of the whole Ashgate Growler thing is. There have been huge transition for some reason. Hardly matters, but I mean, that's going on. Mike's book really discusses the idea of the statement of judgment, the conclusion of judgment that often is present in large-scale disaster investigations, which sort of creates this causal relationship around the failure of foresight. They failed to see, they failed to predict, they failed to identify the potential failure. Now, if you're new school like all of us are, you know that that's a pretty weaselly way to look at it. And that's exactly where Mike got into this topic, is that what the hell does that mean and why do people keep saying it? And what it led him to, because he's a pretty hardcore researcher, this is an empirical discussion for sure. What it led him to was a real deep understanding and research endeavor into foresight. And I think you're going to find Mike's discussion to be really, really interesting. This is one you want to listen to for sure. Other than that, things are great for me. Gosh, things are popping. The new book looks like it's going to be really, really fun and interesting. And I can't even wait for that to get out. That'll be exciting. And there's another one on its horizon. Not that I want to do it, but it seems important. And I'm starting to look really at how we create systems where leaders can be successful, because I think one of the things we've not done a good job is creating a place for leaders to successfully lead safety in the new view. So that's a direction as well. As always, if you have comments or questions or things you want to share with me, I'm open and available to that almost at any time. Just pop me an email, or if you see me in the airport, nudge me. I'm always worth nudging. If you see me in the airport, for goodness sakes, talk to me, because if I'm in the airport, chances are pretty high I'm bored. I know that's a bad thing to say because only boring people are bored. Well, I'm bored in an airport. Chances are relatively high that I'm angry. at some low level, not big angry, but kind of like frustrated angry. And chances are very high that I would love to chat with you at least for a while, unless you're weird or you want to talk about weird crap. And if you're weird and want to talk about weird crap, chances are extremely high I want to talk to you about that. But until then, let's sit back and listen to Mike. He's going to talk to us a bunch about this. This is Dr. Mike Lauder. I think you're going to find this very, very interesting because we are about to go in pursuit of foresight. Well, introduce yourselves because, my guys, this is going to be great because this is a chance for a whole bunch of people to get to meet you and figure out what I know already, which is how interesting you are. So give us an introduction and let's get this baby started.
My name is Mike Lauder. I'm an independent researcher who's did his doctorate on the idea of failure of foresight. And since that time, I have been looking at why we seem to repeat making the same mistakes as we always have in the past. And my doctorate looked at actually how we conceptualize these issues in order to address them. And one of the things I found there was that actually we like to avoid the issue wherever possible in management. So what I'm trying to do is to put together work that gives people thought-provoking questions to ask in their work that makes them start to think about these issues of risk and avoiding failure where possible.
This whole idea of failure of foresight, what did you learn when you did the research for the original sort of for your dissertation? What came out of that?
Well, the thing that came out was that people tend to use the phrase very glibly, especially in inquiries and other sort of post-accident investigations, where they see that there has been a failure to anticipate or a failure to act appropriately. They have found this label failure of foresight, which has been around for some time now, and then just tag it as if now the problem is solved. And I therefore started to look at this to say, what do you actually need to do to avoid failures of foresight? And it became a very much richer, more difficult question to answer. And that's what put me along the lines of Barry Turner's work, because, of course, the phrase came from him.
Yeah, it's incredibly interesting to me because is surprise failure of foresight?
The prize is avoiding failures of foresight. However, this comes down to one of the issues that I look at in the book, which is about the inevitability of failure. And there's a great debate between the high-risk organizations and the normal accident theorists about this idea of inevitability. And one of the things that it suddenly dawned on me was they're arguing this as cats and dogs, because Perrault, when he was talking about inevitability, he was talking about the law of large numbers. If enough things happen, some of it will go wrong. Whereas the people from the high-risk organization, high-reliability organizations, when they talk about inevitability, they they're actually talking of cause and effect. So we have to be clear here about what we mean by inevitable. And to me, inevitable always comes down to the law of large numbers. In the end, something bad will happen.
So where does this take your thinking? I mean, what's this do to you when you sit around and think about this?
Well, this then made me start to look at what is possible to avoid and how much can we avoid? Is a perfect world possible? And I then started to look at something I called the perfect world paradigm. And you can it everywhere. And the basis of it is if we have the right rules written and they're obeyed by people who have been given the appropriate training, we will avoid disaster. Well, life's not like that because life is too rich. I call it normal chaos. And that is every day we know little things change. And we also know
let's pull the string on that. Normal chaos. Oh my goodness. Oh, if I'm not stealing that, that's completely stealable. But I think what you're saying is really, in my mind, fundamentally important, and this discussion needs to be had. I mean, continue. I just wanted to stop you to tell you how much I love the notion of normal chaos. But the idea that sort of the classic Frederick Taylor idea that if we find the one right way, and this couple is really important, and people are obedient, we will have nirvana, has had powerful effects historically on not only the way we create organizations, write procedures, do plans, but also really on the way we're sort of biased towards thinking about what nirvana looks like, what success looks like. And,
absolutely.
And the idea that chaos to a great extent, or variability, but I think chaos is much more impactful. Chaos is normal. That's really interesting and very true. Tell me more.
Well, if you look at any given situation, you know what happened yesterday is no guarantee of what will happen tomorrow. Organizations are changing the whole time. The simplest thing is that they change people over or the time of the day that something happens. There are minor little changes that can make some protocol inapplicable. That there was a piece of work done several years ago called which was titled Verbatim Compliance. And these were people who decided, right, we will try to implement the procedures as written down every time. And they very quickly realized that actually no procedure was generalizable. And they came into two sets of procedures, one which was a guidance best practice, and others like you shall not blow up the factory as a mandated, to say what is possible to decree and what is possible to do. And so we really have to think in terms of regulation about, even if I write the regulation today and the regulation is perfect, does it apply to the situation that I have to apply it to tomorrow? And I was finding in too many circumstances, actually enough had changed so that the rule that you had written was no longer appropriate. Therefore, you cannot go by standards. You have to have flexibility in your organization, which is very much against the way that the courts chase health and safety cases.
So what do we do with this?
Well, that's what Charlie is looking at. But from my point of view, I am trying to get across this idea of, and in this book, I finish it by saying, I know the ideas that I've put across in the book are very complicated and very detailed, but so is life. Actually, what we've got to do is to start to challenge those people who put up these simplistic solutions, who simply label them failures of foresight and now we've solved the problem, say, right, in these circumstances, with the data that was available to them, with the amount of competing problems that they had, how should they have picked this one problem as the issue? A very good case from the States is the Columbia shuttle, which you are probably familiar with.
Sure.
The thing that fascinates me there is that actually the team that were looking at the issue before it blew up on the sheets had over 2,000 critical issues that they thought were more critical. It wasn't that they were avoiding looking at the heat shields. It was just down the line of things that they thought were important that were going to bring the shuttle down. And that, to me, sums up the problem. In this complex, interactive world, how do you actually pick the one that's going to be you in the end?
Amazing. And so that led to this new book. And the book is entitled Pursuit of Foresight, correct?
In Pursuit of Foresight.
In Pursuit of Foresight.
Disaster Incubation Theory Reimagined.
Wow.
And that's because I took Barry Turner's Disaster Incubation Theory and said, right, if I was to apply this to give me foresight, how would it look? And I, one of the chapters in the book, I explain why I chose Turner's theory. Basically, to me, it was the original and it's still the best. It still is the most robust. He was a man way ahead of his time. And I think he's worth giving another airing to.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And this is a great opportunity to do so. So what do we think? What do we do? I mean, what are you learning? What are you coming out of this book thinking? This is really interesting to me.
Well, shall I talk through how I structured the book and looked at the problem?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Because my whole perspective is about giving good questions. It's about generating risk discourse in the terms of Ortwin Wren. And I like Vec's idea of the postcard. In one of his papers, he suggests that if you were to go and look at a piece of art, buy a postcard of it, so you can then set up an internal dialogue between what you think the postcard looks like and what the actual picture looks like, just to get your creative juices and thoughts going. And that's the way that I like to use models and metaphors. So I had another look at Barry Turner's work. And I took three cases, two of them were using Turner's work, to try to understand it better. And although, as I say in my book, he's been quoted over 150 times, when it gets down to who uses his work, it's actually very few people. And there's quite a lot of discrepancy about how they use his work. So what I thought it'd be useful to do in the first part of the book was to have another look at Turner's theory to see if we can really tease out those very good ideas that he had there. And I used three cases. One was a medical error, one was a massive explosion, and the other was a forest fire, to see how other people had used Turner's theory and then see how I would propose that it should be used.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
It helped to clarify some things. In Turner's theory, he had seven stages. And the way that they are portrayed is they're very much all equals. In my book, I took a very different view to how you should do that. For instance, the onset one, which he talks about a major change happening. And it occurred to me when you look at disasters, organizations go from they think the world is happy to it's all gone very bad. Often, in operational terms, happens within about 30 minutes. If you look at things like the Concordia, he deviated from his given path within 30 minutes of hitting the rocks. How long before he actually knew he was going to hit the rocks, that's another matter. If you take the case of the tsunami in Japan a few years ago and the Fukushima, they knew 45 minutes before the waves hit, but actually they thought that their protective layers were sufficient to hold back the tidal wave, and therefore they were only had a couple of minutes from the time they realized that they were going to be swamped. So this 30-minute window was to me a very interesting revelation of this work. The other bit was stages 4 and 5, which aren't so much of my interest because they are rescue and salvage and the cultural readjustment. But the important thing about that is we tend in these models to put learning at the end of the model as to what we can teach other people from our experience. I got to the point in my doctoral research where I looked at the phenomenon that had occurred and in academic writing have said to be the cause. And I got to over 250 of those. When I then started to look at boards of inquiries, I was learning nothing new. So what I would say is we already know what causes disasters. The question is, how do we use that information in order to prevent the next one?
And so really the idea of how we use the question becomes profound, but more importantly, where we use the question. Boy, you're making me think, because you're right. We look at our results as lessons to be learned, or we even call them lessons learned program, yeah, at least in the United States, when in fact, what we want to do is create questions that help us predict in pursuit of foresight. This is very good.
Yeah. Look at what we know and see whether this applies to us. And that's very much what I did. Called them issues of interest, which I think is a fairly good label. You have to remember when he was writing this, which was in the middle of the last century. We can say that now. It sounds an awful long time ago.
I know. It makes us feel old a little, a tiny bit.
It does. And he spoke rigidity of perception, decoy phenomena, things that distract us at the time, information difficulties, bad communications, organizational exclusivity, we don't listen to outsiders and other experts, we know better ourselves, exacerbation of hazards by strangers, people who fail to comply with regulations may be the issue there, or tendency to minimize emergent dangers. Those are very useful and good. However, having looked, remembering how long ago this was and how many other pieces of work had been done, as part of my doctorate, I looked at these phenomena and tried to abstract them through to a new set, which is why I came up with the list that I do. And the list that I reconfigured them to was started with who cares about what? Because We found talking to executives that actually within the boardroom, executives can be concerned about different things because those are their areas of responsibility. And executives will be fighting over a particular issue, not because they disagree with the other person, but because of what their priorities there. And one of the things that I did with one of my colleagues, Mar Baker, was actually look at this and get people to air what it is they cared about, so the other people would therefore know the perspective they were taking on the problem and where their natural tendency was to push a particular area. So that's why I put that one in. The second one was a practical drift, a phrase that was given us by Scott Snook. But there are so many places where what existed no longer applies. And that's what I use that label to find. That leads us naturally onto the idea of erroneous assumptions. We assume that something will be right or is the case or is appropriate, and our assumptions turn out to be wrong. Frequently the case in accidents. Failure to launch is where the team wasn't ready, wasn't skilled enough, didn't know. It amazed me when I was looking at Borders inquiries into mining disasters. How many of those, it wasn't because they weren't doing the latest things. It was because the team simply didn't know the basics to do, weren't following the basic regulations. So that was an important one. Structural secrecy goes back to the idea from Diane Vaughan of a piece of information is held in one part of the organization, but not known by another part,
right,
of the organization. A communication problem. Second last one is dysfunctional momentum. Organizations have a momentum of their own. If the management did nothing, the organization would still continue to roll in a particular direction. Sometimes that natural momentum of the organization is contrary to where the organization wants to go. So management need to be aware of where the culture and such like are taking the organization and how that works against where they want to be. And the final one I've labeled the Plowman effect after a very good paper I found that describes in detail. But to the layman, this is about where small decisions added together take you away from where you want to be. Each decision in its own right might be the right decision, but when they are all brought together, they don't add up to the conclusion you want it to be. Other pieces of work on this are things like a compound abstraction for those people who look at it. So there's these gave me a richer set of pictures of those things to look for. And the way that I proved these was I went back through my three case studies and I picked out examples of all of those from my three case studies. And that was a random selection just to prove that actually these are common themes in most accidents.
Wow. That's amazing. This sounds great. I'm really excited about this. In Pursuit of Foresight. Brilliant.
If I can then explain what I then did with it.
Yeah, of course, Mike. Of course.
I then took these ideas of the construct and using, again, a book about military failures, there was about half a dozen military failures. I plotted each one of these against my framework to expand the framework and to show how it works. The final chapter was a fully worked case study where I took the Yom Kippur War work by Frank Stech, who was one of the people who had originally used disaster incubation theory, and reconfigured the data him and another academic, Zivi Zanir, an Israeli, on the Yom Kippur War to show how, by structuring it, the information that they had in this way, it would give you a fresh insight to what was actually happening. But more importantly, it was giving you hard questions to ask at critical points about things like the precautionary norms. Are those things that we have put in place still appropriate to prevent the type of failure that they were put in place for? So the last chapter is the easiest to read and is for anyone who wants to just dip into this subject to see what we're talking about, as it gives this graphic description of the events that were leading up to it and the clues that were missed.
This sounds great, actually. It's available now?
Yes, it is available now.
It's great.
It's published by Gower in England and their representative in the States.
Gotcha. Yeah, so Gower's great. Wow, this is – Mike, this sounds fun. I like where you're going, and I like the fact that you're pushing us there. That's great. It's exciting. So what do you think – what's your final notion now? What do you think? If you were to sum it up, really, what'd you learn?
What I learned was that foresight is incredibly difficult, and we must not underestimate the difficulties in foreseeing all the possibilities that might befall us. We should do what we can. It's not a counsel of despair. We can do sensible things to reduce the risks around us, but we should try to get away from the idea that we can make the world safe, that if only we do everything right, everything will be nice in the end. Sometimes life just comes back and bites us, and we need to find a way of coping with that.
Sometimes life just comes around and bites you. Yes, Mike, you are right. It bites you. Holy cow. I don't know if that's operationally acceptable to leadership, but we can talk about that later. I think this is very interesting. And it's interesting because we need people like Mike to have these discussions with us, because he's really not afraid to dig in empirically and look for things. I think the postcard story, the way we use our notion of what something is versus what something actually is. If you go to a place, you buy a postcard of it, and then you look at the thing and you look at the postcard and you sort of have a dialogue between the two. That's really, that's pretty cool. In a way, that puts us in a position to think a lot about how we imagine work happens, sort of the nirvana, as Mike would say, the reality, and the way work actually happens, which is much different than nirvana, much, much different. I have a lot of things, but nirvana is not yet achieved. Although the journey to nirvana is filled with smart people like you and Mike. And that, I think, is a good place to end this podcast. Thank you for your time. This has been a great show. I hope this makes you think. If nothing else, you can jump on the internet and look for In Pursuit of Foresight and see what comes out, because I think it's worth looking for. Until then, my friends, this has been the Pre-Accident Podcast. Thank you for your time. It is always worthwhile talking to you. I'm sure we'll have lots more to say. Have lots of fun, will you? Learn something new every single day. Go out and have a good time, and for goodness sakes, be safe. I'm very special.
Yeah, afraid, mate, you're not.